Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Tune in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David and Nikki Nellis. We're coming to you live from the fabulous, exotic, overdone, glassed-in radio booth here at the Line Hotel.
Well, I do want to say, for those of you who want to celebrate Chinese New Year, Spoken English is doing an incredible Chinese New Year menu for the entire week.
And those of you who don't know what she's talking about, Spoken English is a great restaurant right here in the lobby of the Line Hotel.
Well, it's not in the lobby. In the lobby is brothers and sisters.
That's part of the lobby.
That is not the lobby. That is another
room. Right. This is our first fight.
Anyway.
Never had one
so
before.
So Eric Bruner Yang, Spoken English. It's a stand-up restaurant, 20 spaces, and make your reservation for it because there is going to be a whole Chinese New Year menu for the entire week, and it looks pretty fabulous. I can't wait to try it.
All right, so let me tell you what's going on the show today. You know, this show is different than our Sunday show, which is more like a variety show. This is a deep dive into one subject, and today we're diving in with two friends, people we met 10 years ago when they were just going into business, and now they're like aristocrats of the distilling business. Scott and Becky Harris, they own Catoctin Mountain Distillery.
No, Catoctin Creek.
Creek.
The mountain is what you climb.
They own Catoctin Mountain, but they also own Catoctin Creek Distillery. We met, I think, Scott, you were on the show first, and Becky was not with you. Catoctin Creek, I think
Scott likes to keep Becky hidden. He doesn't want anybody to know who she is or what she does.
Seeing her, I can see why he doesn't want her, you know.
Right.
She's the Howard Hughes of our business.
Right.
You know, nobody knows she really exists.
What are you going to do with those fingernails anyway?
Okay.
But we met them, and now Catoctin Creek is the first distillery in Loudoun County, Virginia, since Prohibition. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you started it. I mean, I'll let you get into your backgrounds, but they started, as I said, 10 years ago. Happy anniversary.
Yeah, and, very exciting. It's your anniversary this month.
That's right.
Right?
February 14th, Valentine's Day.
So let's back up a little bit, and let's talk about both of your background and where the inspiration to get into distilling started.
So basically,
Scott started drinking at the age of three.
Yeah. I was born in Germany, so we drink early. And we were both engineers, and we had been working in different engineering type jobs. Becky's a chemical engineer, so she was working for companies like Ciba Vision doing contact lenses, and
I see
clamshell containers like the styrofoam containers you take home from your to-go, you know, stuff. And a computer
that are like now illegal,
right?
No more styrofoam,
right? And
nice going, Becky. So you created climate change, is that
thanks,
right?
Thanks, Becky.
That's right. She would point out they're totally recyclable, but
yes.
And I was working in government contracting and telecom. So the first job I ever had out of college was working on what today we call 911. So that was a new thing back then, and so you know that was cool. It had purpose. You know, we were saving lives, getting somebody if you dialed 911 to like show on a screen that you know that somebody lives at such and such address and they have a heart condition and you need to come in through the back door because the front door is always locked or whatever. Those kinds of things were interesting. And then I transitioned into government contracting as telecom sort of fell apart in the 90s. So I was working for a customer that was the U.S. Navy, putting basically spy gear on U.S. airplanes, U.S. Navy airplanes. And that was kind of interesting. It actually timed right along with 9/11. And at the time, that seemed like a really purposeful thing. We were saving lives and helping prevent, you know, disasters from happening. And then as years go by, you know, things got more bureaucratic and, you know, I was approaching 40 and, you know, quite honestly, I was hitting my midlife crisis and I was finding myself sitting in a windowless room all of my day, sitting, you know, 3-hour commute each day, you know, hour and a half in, hour and a half out, sitting in this windowless cubicle doing PowerPoint charts for somebody who would never read them. You know, they just file them away as like a deliverable. And I was like, God, if I was going to construct for myself a perfect version of hell, this is it,
right?
Like
we're here.
Sitting in this goddamn room. Oops, sorry, there's the first curse of the day.
Okay.
That's not really a curse. You can say that on broadcast radio.
Can you?
Yeah.
Try this. Shit.
There you go.
I'll get to it.
Okay.
Anyway, so yeah, I had this really shitty job. And it was, you know, it wasn't a shitty job, but I just didn't want to do it anymore. And so I kept daydreaming about what, you know, what else then? You know, I'm having this like running dialogue in my head, you know. So, you know, part of me is like the part of me saying, well, you know, you got to be responsible. You got a kid, you got family, you know, you got to pay for college and all this stuff. And
that may be where I screwed up. Sorry. Keep going.
Right.
So anyway, I'm having this conversation and I was like, well, I really enjoyed it. When I was 15 years old, I worked in a winery. And, you know, in a winery, you know, you had, you press the grapes, you ferment the grapes, you bottle it, you ferment it, you do all this stuff, not in that order. And at the end of the day, you've got a bottle and you can present it to your customer and you can say, look, I made this and I'm proud of it. And so I really like that. But at the time, Loudoun County, of course, had like 40 wineries, right? You can't throw a rock without hitting a winery. And so I was like, well, I don't want to do a winery. You know, I really like whiskey. And what I tell people is, you know, 20 years of government contracting taught me a great love of whiskey. And so I was like, I want to make whiskey, not knowing anything about the business, the distribution, the sales, you know, all the things
or
that
the
are so challenging.
Right. Of producing it in Virginia.
Absolutely. So you come into it naive and there's a certain bliss in that ignorance. You're like, well, I can do that. And, you know, and I was inspired by these sort of folklore stories of like some, you know, Italian immigrant who comes to the country with $5 in his pocket. And I'm like, well, if he can do it, then I can do it, you know. So I felt sort of emboldened by that folklore.
So what the first thing you did was you flew to Italy?
Right.
And then
and,
I want to make good whiskey, therefore I'm going to Italy.
Right. And then I'm going to come back here.
No, so the first thing I did was I brought this idea to Becky and I said, Becky, you know, we should start a distillery. And her first response was, you know,
yeah,
that's the craziest fucking thing I've ever heard in my life.
No, but Becky, let me ask you a question. I mean, were you a big whiskey drinker?
I was not. I really wasn't much of a whiskey drinker at all. I really liked, I drank wine occasionally, but I wasn't a big drinker at all.
Mm-hmm. Says a woman who went to the bar today and had a cocktail. Go ahead.
I've evolved.
Scott has been a great
10
influence
years later.
On your
well,
life.
Yeah, we started a business. I need to drink now.
Right. Amen, sister.
Right. When he came to me with the idea, it was like, well, you know, I don't want to be not supportive. At the time, I was home with two kids who were essentially... probably, I think the first one was in middle school and the second one was just short of middle school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, you know, I can feel where he's coming from. And I want to kind of not be the person who always says, well, Jesus Christ, you got to get this. You know, you've got to do this because we need the money for this and that. And so I said, you know, why don't you write a business plan?
That was excellent advice.
Thinking
exactly
that'll
because
stop him.
That's exactly what I was thinking. I was like,
right, because writing a business plan is sucks.
It torture. Says you're serious.
Right.
And
but it's so hard
it
to
isn't
do.
Easy to do.
Well, and I was so ADD. I was like, ooh, yeah, business plan. Right. I should do that. That's right.
That would have, honestly, that would have stopped me in my tracks.
Right. So I actually, well, I had a lot of free time on my hands. So, you know, sitting at my desk during the day, I would come in, I'd get to my desk like 8 o'clock, 8:30 or something. And I would finish whatever I had to do for that day within an hour. And then I would just sit there on Facebook for the rest of the day. I was like, God, I'm dying here. So I started writing the business plan. And basically the business plan, we had, you know, sort of peaks and valleys. You know, there were some highs and lows. But eventually the plan that we settled on.
Well, it was funny because he almost gave up, which is what I expected him to do. Really, you
as
know,
a
it was like
wife at a
yeah,
QR.
Exactly. I was like, you know, he's going to talk himself out of this because the numbers obviously
right.
don't make any damn sense. And so
the
it was like he came to me at some point. I think it was like in February or something of that of 2009, just about the time when we founded it, actually, right shortly after that, he was like, you know, I just can't seem to make the numbers work. And
I was
said,
trying
you know,
to
go.
Build a distillery on that first business plan. It was like Glenmorangie, you know, it was like a full on distillery, like Maker's Mark, like some big operation.
Instead of starting small.
Right. And
you probably didn't have a lot of models to like,
not a
right.
lot of
do you know what I mean? Like all you had were these things.
All we had were what we were seeing on tours.
Well, and I'm also going to add that, you know, you were part of. Like you and quite a, obviously, if you look at the distilling landscape 10 years later compared to when you started? I mean, a bunch of you all sort of started at the mm-hmm. laws were changed and all these distilleries were able to come together, but there was really no model
right.
to follow.
Not
for
like
a
there
small,
is now.
Right.
No.
Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. so all you had were the big ones. So right. I can see that that would really screw up
right.
what your numbers look like.
So my first plan of the business was to get all this investment from these investors, $10 million business, you know, set up this plant, and that
Wait,
was never going to happen. It was like a $10 million,
right.
yeah, that was never going to happen. Like, nobody's going to invest in a small company that has nothing but except, you know, something on paper. I had no experience, I had no nothing. And so...
You know, unless you've got collateral to...
Exactly.
Right. And so we were sitting, actually, it was funny, we were sitting in Quiznos eating a sandwich, I remember it, and I was going to go on a workshop the next day to Chicago, and Becky was like, we were basically ready to chuck it all in, and Becky's like, look, the Chicago flight has already been paid for, you've already paid for the workshop, just go, have fun, don't worry about anything, you come back home, you go back to work on Monday, we'll get on with our lives. And so I went to the Chicago workshop, and it was a workshop at a craft distillery, and when I saw that distillery, I was like, oh, I could do this.
Okay.
Like, this is small.
So what was
this
the distillery?
Koval, which is Robert and Sonat Bernecker, and they really served as a model for us because they had a small still, they had a small operation, they were doing things literally by hand. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, we could do this. And so I came back with like a huge paring knife and I just sliced away big pieces of the business plan that weren't needed. And I brought it down to a level that, you know, Becky and I, we never inherited an ounce of money from our parents. So everything we had...
And my parents stuck it to me too. What's
yeah.
going on with that?
Yeah, well, my dad was in the Army. He didn't make any damn money.
No, my parents were just cheap.
My parents are still alive, but I got nothing coming.
So we basically had every ounce of money that we had saved as engineers working for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And so the proposition of this new business plan was, you know, let's take all of that money that we saved for 20 years and let's put it into this distillery. And so to put you into time context, you know, it was 2009. It was the whole time of...
The bottom had just dropped out in 2008.
Too big to fail. Right.
Right.
Lehman Brothers was collapsed. I mean, everything was going
countrywide,
down.
Countrywide, like everything. I remember it.
Right. And so we were looking at our savings, and everything was going down, 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 down. And so the panic was, let's use this money before it's gone.
It disappears.
Before it's gone, right?
Because
we saved for 20 years, and it's going to be gone. So let's do this now. And so we kind of had this urgency. So once again, Becky came in as sort of the voice of reason. She's like, look, the business plan you wrote looks really good now. I actually think it seems pretty good.
Well, and it was interesting because that process, too, was also there were other people involved in it. You know, we have a friend locally who runs a construction company, and we had shown the business plan to a bunch of people, and they were all like, oh, this is so great. You know, you guys are going to be great. It's going to be amazing. And
it's nice that you got such positive response. But that wasn't helpful.
Like, I showed it to my dad, and he's like, oh, my God, this is amazing. It's like, no, I need feedback. I need to know.
Like, what are we doing? And so this woman.
And you can come live with us.
Right. And so this woman runs a construction company, you know, we said, would you mind looking at it? And she said, oh, you know, I'm pretty busy, but let me see what I can do. And so she actually did. She ripped it up.
And at first, it was really daunting because I was really, like, depressed. You know, she had X'd with big red marker, you know, all this stuff, like the teacher went crazy on
right.
it. And then I had to shift my thinking, and I was like, look, every one of these, she saved me. Like, she just saved me $100,000 here and $1 million here. Like, if I can just solve all these problems, and there were, like, 30 of them, then I can do this business. So I had to sort of turn it around and say, she did me a favor in showing me all these flaws, and now I have to fix this.
So, but what was the initial plan? Did you have to build something?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So,
okay.
So the initial plan came down from like $10 million to like $500,000, right?
That's a big difference.
It's a big difference. And so we basically then had this plan that said, we're going to have a small distillery and a little garage, and we're going to, you know, show up in our pajamas and make liquor and sell it to the ABC.
Or it was even going to be on a out in the county on a farm
right.
or something.
You know, some
yeah.
little
like in
place.
An unused barn
yeah.
space
right.
or something like that.
Right. And so Becky's next sort of gauntlet to me was, why don't you take it to the bank and see if you can get some financing? And again, in 2009,
nobody was,
you know,
giving
she
out
was
any
like,
money.
They're going to say no. And then I would have been the supportive, loving wife and then get on with your day job. Right. Because we need to pay for college. And so we took it to the bank. And Like 2, 3, 4 weeks later, the bank came back and they said, "You've been approved for an SBA loan." And we were like, "Holy shit, what?"
That's amazing.
And so we were really, that was really sort of our big, you know, miracle
well,
moment.
Well, even before what was that, the legality of distilling in Loudoun County at that time?
Well, nobody had charted these waters before.
Okay, so it was brand new.
It was brand new. So the county level, like there were federal procedures and there were state procedures for how to get licensed, but there was, the county knew nothing. And so, you know, when we went to the county, they were like, "Well, is it like a winery?" And we're like, kind of like a winery. And that actually worked against us because they didn't really like the wineries because they have all these ordinances with noise and all this stuff. And wineries, unlike distilleries, have by right. So the wineries can set up shop whether the county likes it or not. But with distilleries, they had a chance to say no because so the county said no to us. And so we couldn't set up a county winery or a
so
county distillery.
So we couldn't do it on a farm in a little quaint.
They told
just
us,
even distilling,
right,
not people coming in and
right,
tasting it and
told,
buying bottles.
None of that was legal yet.
Okay.
So they told us that we had to basically go down to Dulles Airport and get an industrial space down there. And we're like, that's not what we
that
are.
Make
that's
any
not what
sense.
We're going to do.
Right.
And so that's why we went to the town of Percival. And the town of Percival saw the vision and said, "Hey, yeah, we like what you're talking about, and we'll put you here in town.
Here's a place you could start."
Right.
So what was it?
So we started in a little bitty garage.
It's
like
a flex warehouse space. So it's got the kind of place where you have a car repair or electrician. It has a garage door and a front door that are both like right next to each other.
Okay.
And there's a whole bunch of those.
It's
same
about as big
businesses.
As the lobby here. I mean, it was
2,000
tiny.
Square feet roughly.
And did you know how to build this? I mean, did you know what
you
needed?
So we took classes and the internet, Google is amazing. And, and you know, what we skipped over is, I mean, at one point in this, I came to Becky, and Becky's a chemical engineer, and I said, "I would like you to make whiskey." And she was, you know, nonchalant about it. You know, her thing was, "Yeah, I can make your whiskey. Whiskey distilling."
I learned how to make contact lenses. I can learn to make whiskey. Contact lenses are, frankly, way
more
harder.
Right. It seems like they're more difficult.
Yes.
She was like, "You need to make sure that we can make money.
Whiskey makes you blind if you drink too much of it."
Only the bad stuff.
Right. But contact lenses help you see. Right.
It's like, my question was, could you make money making whiskey? Because that's really...
But is that what you started
honestly,
making?
Honestly, it's still the
whiskey
problem.
First?
Yep. So once we got the bank money, the gears started to fall into place, and we started to really roll into this. We got licensed. We got the equipment. You know, we got the lease on the commercial space. It was actually quicker than that. So we settled the loan in at the end of the fiscal year. So September 30th, the end of the fiscal year. And then we got licensed on December 26th, the day after Christmas, the TTB, the federal agents.
I don't think anybody's ever done it faster than we did,
honestly. And so by January 4th, we had our license in hand, and we were distilling the first alcohol after
now,
that.
Now, were you already playing mad scientist at home? Were you already working with recipes?
No,
were
we really weren't.
With
we really what? I mean,
did you know what
home
you
distilling
wanted?
Is illegal.
Okay.
Even if you're just doing it to drink at home.
Okay.
Federal regulations say that stills are illegal. I mean, people set fires with those kind of things. So
that's
kind of
moonshining.
Exactly right. And for them, that is
sometimes people
so
will
people
argue.
Think moonshine is just a grain alcohol.
Right.
It essentially is. It's
right. Essentially
unaged.
A tax unpaid alcohol is mostly what it
unbarreled,
is. It could be anything.
Yeah.
It could be brandy.
But
it could be
let
whiskey.
Me ask a question, because I'm thinking of Todd Thrasher, who has a distillery in his new place that is really it's a small distillery.
I haven't been there, but I'm excited to go see
it. He described it to us, and it sounds like... So did you, while you're waiting for all these permits and all that, you went and got your still, I guess?
Yep. So you have to buy all that stuff beforehand and have it in place and hooked up and ready to go, never having used it once, because that's illegal, for the TTB to give you permission.
Yes.
Right.
And the Virginia
and so
ABC. Which
it's common these days that usually, I mean, a lot of people don't do that, and then they get the approval. The inspection, you know, they used to send a person out and they would walk through and inspect it and then be like, "Okay, here's your approval."
The state still does.
And the state still does that. But the federal agent called me on the phone, and it was Christmas, day after Christmas, and she called me on the phone and she was asking me all these questions. And I was like, "Are you coming to visit?" And she's like, "No, we're good with this." You know, so she just gave me the approval over the phone.
Yeah, but the ABC did show up.
But the ABC did show up. And but the ABC inspection was... kind of like he had never seen a distillery before. This was early days, and so he was kind of like, "Oh, gee whiz, this is cool."
Oh my god!
Not really
amazing.
Like, you know, in our business or trying to figure out if we're doing it right.
Okay, so you get the licensing.
Mm-hmm.
The distillery is officially
running. Yep.
Open for business.
So basically, our first customer was to be the Virginia ABC, which is the
but
state.
Wait. But before you tell me about your first customer, what's your product?
Oh, so so our first.
Is that what we're drinking?
The first product is the Roundstone Rye here. Yeah, the Roundstone Rye.
When we went to the state, they were the first. It was funny because they actually the first
That's
thing
really good.
Scott called her and said, you know, hey, we've got this distillery, and she's like, just tell me it's not going to be another goddamn vodka.
And so at that point, I scratch off on my business plan, vodka off the list.
Right. Vodka
off
is the out. List. We don't need any vodka.
No vodka.
No, only
and vodka
whiskey.
Was waning at that time. And if you remember, like from Sex and the City, you know, it's like Cosmos this and everything mm-hmm. and martini vodkas and all this stuff. Vodka was coming down, and it was the time when we had sort of vodka jumping the shark, and it was like mango vodka and buttered popcorn vodka and all
right.
this stuff.
Do people
and
do that? Vodka? Is vodka easier to make?
Well, it is. You don't have to age it. So you can make it in 2 weeks and it's out on market.
Right.
But with whiskey, years in the barrel. And
well, that's what I was going to ask. So your first whiskey
was
really young.
So the first things we took to the Virginia ABC, we had to make this appointment in February. We had to go to the ABC for an appointment they call a listing appointment, where you get permission to sell it on their shelves. And it's on every shelf in the state,
okay.
or most of the shelves in the state. And so we had taken with us our moonshine, which is easy to make, 2 weeks. Gin, easy to make, 2 weeks, and whiskey, which takes years. And the whiskey that we had been, it was a prototype whiskey. We had made it in like little tiny barrels, and I had literally printed the labels on inkjet printer, and then Elmer's glued them to the bottle. Like, these were total prototype bottles
right.
that I had brought to them. And so then, like a couple weeks later, they called us up and they said, you've been approved. We're going to take the whiskey, not the gin, not the moonshine.
You're like, no. I have gin.
I'm like, son of a bitch. Like,
well, but let me ask a question. Let me ask this question.
Okay, but I want to find out what happened.
You will find out what happened in a minute, because if there's only a finite amount of shelf space in the ABC store.
Exactly.
Right? So... do you have to pay shelving fees?
No.
I mean, how do you get space?
Virginia ABC just pays us a wholesale price, and then they commit to putting it on X amount of shelves, and then they will continue to sell it as long as it moves.
And they
as long
just
as
decide
it's
if they
it
like it or yours
right.
above somebody
and
else's?
So my whole value proposition, I went in there. It's funny.
It's mostly a sales proposition. How much can you sell?
Right, and mm-hmm. they do give you some preference because you're a Virginia company in Virginia.
So we have to sell less to stay there than might...
than, say, Pennsylvania.
Somebody from California.
All right, so go back. Now you got to make whiskey.
So I'm in this thing, and we get listed, and it's like, holy crap, we have a customer. That's great, but it's the whiskey. Like, this is really going to be hard.
And you don't have product, right?
Right. Well, so we had product, but it was a month and a half old. And if you look at our original batch one bottles, it says aged 1.5 months. Like, it was brown barely. But
it tasted good, though.
It tasted good.
It
and
did.
It was enough to sell. And so what was cool is they gave us the logins to the back end system where you can see the inventory. And so we could see, for instance, that product was being dispersed into, say, the Herndon store, the Sterling store, the McLean store.
I think we
you
had
know, all these
stores,
right?
I think it was
and so we
stores.
Could see that it was happening. Like Wednesday, they're getting a supply of this stuff.
Wait, so how many bottles are you producing at this
so
point?
So at this point, so we're little. Producing like 1,000 tops.
Okay, that's what and I mean.
So,
I figured.
And so we would see that. And this was the early days when Facebook wasn't like, you know, clamping down
we
on
using,
how it...
They didn't have business.
Yes. Right. And so we would put on Facebook, we would say, look... Facebook, and we had like 1,000 fans by the time we started. We would say, okay, look, there's liquor hitting the McLean store today at Wednesday, and people go in and boom, and it was gone. And then we'd say, okay, Thursday, it's going to hit, you know, Arlington and Clarendon and blah, 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 and boom, it was gone. And so then the Virginia ABC was like, these guys can sell whiskey. We've never seen anything like this before, you know, mm-hmm. with craft spirits. This was the first time this was happening in Virginia ABC. And so that helped us. So the next time we went in, we took the gin and the Mosby spirit, which was our moonshine, and they said, okay, now we'll sell the gin. And so we were able to build up our profile. And as we got older, the whiskey got older. And today, you know, it's much older than it was in those early days. But that's how we got started, was just selling that.
But
really
do you do all your
juice.
Bottling, labeling,
everything
packing,
by hand.
Shipping?
Everything by hand.
So how many people work with you?
Well, in the early days, it was all volunteers. So we would put out a thing on Facebook and say, hey, we got to ship 50 boxes tomorrow. Can somebody come in? We'll buy you pizza. And we were labeling by hand and putting all this stuff together. And we've actually done these.
And they did it for pizza?
They did it for pizza.
This is like pizza real and free whiskey. Yeah. This is bootstrapping.
Boy, these must
in
be
the
like out in Loudoun County. It's like ex-Confederate soldiers with nothing to
let
do.
Let me tell you. To this day, we still do those bottling workshops. Every month, we would do a bottling workshop. We'd have people come in, and we'd give them free tastings, and we'd do this experience. And then people would do this, and every month became every 2 weeks, and then all of a sudden we're doing them every weekend.
Did you start hiring some of these people? At some point,
you know, we were like, God, we're spending every weekend bottling. Like, we'd like to have a life. And one of our investors who is now passed, his name was Kerry Rowe. He was my old boss from my old contracting company. He came in one day. He was quite wealthy. And he came in one day, and he's like, you guys are working so hard. Like, is there anything that you need in your life that would make this easier?
All your money.
And I just said, kind of offhandedly, I was like, God, we really could use a bottling machine. He's like, well, what do those cost? And I was like, I don't know, 50 grand. And he sat down right then and there and wrote me a check for 50 grand.
Oh, my God.
He's like, go buy yourself a bottling machine. I was like, oh, my God, are you kidding me?
So, wait, how were you doing it before the bottle?
We were literally filling it with a little filler. Not a funnel, but it's like the next step up. It's like a little filling machine, and then we were literally hand labeling the stickers on there.
Put the corks in by hand.
Put the corks in by hand, and all of it by hand.
Wow.
And so he bought us a bottling machine, and at that point, we stopped doing the bottling workshops. We don't need them anymore. We can have one person do the work of 40 people, and we can just do this easy. And people started to call in and complain, like, why don't you guys do the bottling workshops? They're so much fun. And so today, to this day, it's been like 5 years since we had that machine. We still do the bottling workshops, but now it's mostly just as a marketing and, people come in, they get to see the distillery, get a really
more
nice
like a tour.
You know what this sounds like? Yeah. Henry Ford's story. And then we built the assembly line.
Right. And everybody complained they wanted to build their own cars.
Right, build it by hand.
That's an amazing
story.
And what a gift.
Oh, yeah.
What a gift.
What a sweet guy he was. He was a really
generous
person.
Okay, so you get all these orders. You have your first big client. And they finally order the moonshine and the gin. Can we talk about, we have to take a break. You know, why don't we take a break now? When we come back, I want to talk about.
Had you been on our show by the time this was happening, or was that?
Yeah, I think we were probably on your show right after we started selling into Virginia.
So that's why your success
in D.C. Yeah, absolutely.
Because what I want to do is I want to talk about all the flavor profiles and over the last 10 years, how tastes have changed, how what you're doing is changing, et cetera. This is David and Nikki Nellis. We're at the Gorgeous Lion Hotel on Full Service Radio. We'll be back in just a sec.
Man, if you don't know what Get Up Down means by now, I guess we're just going to break it down for you. Rock the beat.
This track is called Astral Traveling by Keto. And if you're tuned in, you're listening to Full Service Radio. We'll be right back.
All right, we're back on Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David and Nikki Nellis. We're talking to Scott and Becky Harris of Catoctin Creek. What idiot said mountain? Catoctin Creek.
Somebody said that.
Distillery. And the whole story of like how this, it's the best kind of story because it's not somebody who grew up and mom and dad were moonshiner. You know what I mean? I mean, you came at it from science and math, really.
Yeah, pretty much.
And
I'm bored of
And boredom.
And disillusionment.
It's nice to know where our federal dollars are going. Facebook and crossword puzzles. And
well, but, tell us about what we're drinking.
So the first one I poured for you was our standard Catoctin Creek Roundstone Rye at 80
proof.
It's our flagship spirit. This spirit is putting my children through college.
Okay.
And it's a really approachable, smooth. It's buttery. It's got sort of qualities of nut and fruit in it. It's just a really,
He talks like a real distiller now, doesn't he?
How long is that aged now?
This is 2 years old.
And is that normally what you're doing?
Yeah, that's pretty much the standard for this. So what's interesting about having a relatively young rye, as opposed to bourbon, bourbon needs a little more time in the barrel. It tastes really hot and unattractive at young ages. But rye can be quite nice if you distill it properly. And so with a young aged rye like this, you get a really fresh grain-forward flavor. So as a whiskey ages longer and longer and longer in the barrel, you're basically just absorbing more and more wood.
Can we back up a little bit? For the uninitiated,
mm-hmm.
can we go through whiskey, rye, bourbon? Like,
yeah, like what they are?
What's the designation?
The categories?
Yeah, the categories of each.
What makes
and what's,
them different?
What sure. makes them different and what's the ingredients? And
sure.
then we can talk to Becky about what she does to make...
Make it nice.
No, make yours different from somebody else's.
Sure. So in the categories of whiskey, whiskey is the super category of...
And is it whiskey with an E or just...
Any way you want to spell it. So
okay.
Typically, if you're from Scotland or Canada, you spell it without the E. And if you're from America or Ireland, you spell it with an E.
Okay.
That designation isn't super important because like companies like Catoctin Creek and like Maker's Mark spell it with no E to sort of pay homage to our Scottish heritage.
Mm-hmm.
So... It kind of goes back and forth, but whiskey with an E, whiskey without an E.
I'm just going to interrupt. So what about scotch?
Scotch is whiskey.
It is whiskey.
It is
but
whiskey.
It's only from Scotland?
It's from Scotland.
Okay, just
so,
making sure.
So whiskey is the super category of anything that has grain in it that's aged in a barrel, essentially. There's
okay.
a little other categories, but that's the big one. Scotch, then, is barley whiskey. That's the ingredient, barley. That's aged in a barrel in Scotland. So you can't make scotch in America. People say in the tasting room, when are you going to make scotch? And I say, as soon as I move to Scotland.
Right.
It is protected by treaties. And so it's just like champagne. You can't make scotch
right,
in Kentucky.
Right, it has a designation.
Right.
Okay, but you can make a barley.
You can make a barley.
Whiskey.
I could make a single malt here in America, but it's a single malt, not a scotch. And it could taste...
Only because you can't call it a scotch.
You just can't call it a scotch.
That's all. Okay.
It could be
just like
chemically
sparkling.
Chemically identical to scotch, but it's not called scotch.
Got it.
Same thing for Irish. Irish has to be made in Ireland, and that's also made from barley. So with bourbon has to be made in America. It started in Kentucky, and people argue with me, but they're wrong. Anywhere in America.
Just so you know.
Yeah.
You're wrong.
There are bourbons from New York that you can make a bourbon in Hawaii. It has to be made from American corn. In America, and bourbon is also protected, so you can't make bourbon in Germany or Scotland or anywhere else. So
okay, but bourbon is not a whiskey.
But bourbon is a whiskey. It's a whiskey from corn.
Got it, because
whiskey is the major umbrella.
Is the major
umbrella.
Category.
Got
right.
it. And
anything
it has to be made
that's
from a grain.
Right. So okay. bourbon is from corn, mm-hmm. mostly corn, 51% or more corn. And so then rye, which is what we're making, is made from the rye grain. And so that's like your Jewish rye bread, mm-hmm. you know, pumpernickel. It's the same grain as that. And if you know the flavor difference between, say, white bread and rye bread's a little sour and a little more spicy.
Oh, yeah.
It has that different tangy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that shows up in the whiskey. So you can also have whiskey from wheat, oats, millet, you name it. If it's a grain, you can make it. Those are more esoteric. You don't see them very often, but they exist. So the major four are basically barley, wheat, rye, and corn.
Okay, so your first one
is rye. And all we do is rye.
Okay.
100% rye, and that's because that's the historical grain spirit of Virginia, and that's what we love.
Well, that's a very rye commentary on what you do, but you know, I went through your website. You know what would be very helpful? Because when I was going through it, she beat me to the punch in asking that question, would be something that really, for the uninitiated, that really explains all of that.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I think
people are confused by it.
Yeah, yeah. We spent a lot of time on the tours explaining that. And, I mean, the Wikipedia pages are pretty interesting about whiskey for these things. But just, like, what is whiskey? Like, a lot of people come in and say, you guys make great bourbon. And I'm like, well, thank you, because that's a compliment. But actually, you know, it's
we
not
don't
bourbon.
Make bourbon.
It's not
right.
bourbon. So typically in America, the two major spirits have been either bourbon or rye. And bourbon and rye are both made from a recipe, right? Just think of it as a recipe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called a mash bill. So mash bill means recipe for the whiskey. And so that recipe for bourbon only has to be 51% corn to be called bourbon. And so typically, like if you take Four Roses or Woodford, you're talking something like 60% corn, but then there's 40% left, right? So they might have 35% rye in there. So it's got that spicy character of the rye.
Well, that's the flavoring grains.
Right.
Rye is a flavoring grain.
And then they might have like 5% barley. That's the sugar they need to make the whiskey. And then there's rye recipes, mash bills, that are like the opposite. So it's like 60% rye, but there's a little bit of corn and there's a little bit of barley. And so what we do that's different is it's 100% rye.
So it's just 100%.
Just rye and only rye.
And what made you decide, Becky, when you were distilling to go that route?
Well, what we wanted to do was 100% rye is a lot harder.
I bet.
It
sounds like when you're mixing, you're kind of cheating.
It's very sticky. Rye is really sticky. That's why you don't see rye beers, like 100% rye beers, because it won't louder. It won't separate from the wort.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're doing this, typically in pot still distillation, and that is really important to what we do, because one of the secrets of making a young rye really delicious is to make that young rye in a pot still.
As opposed to a
continuous column beer still. Stills are what they use in Kentucky. So when you go to Kentucky and you go to a really large distillery, most of them will send the fermented mash right through it, and it basically in 3 minutes it will take 300 gallons and make it into whiskey.
Wow.
A pot still is what you think of when you think of distillations. It's what you see in Scotland. It's essentially you put it in this big kettle and it boils, and over a period of time all the alcohol boils off and comes out. And so what that does is it gives it time. And it also allows me to make cuts. So at the beginning and end of that distillation, I can make cuts for flavor and cuts for quality. The heads have things like acetaldehyde, methanol, all those things. To me, they smell and taste like nail polish remover. It's mm-hmm. just not good. And the tails have things like long chain alcohols that give it that kind of burny flavor. So when you're tasting something and it's like a really raw whiskey,
yeah.
And it's like it feels like it's burning all over your mouth and you can't seem to get
the flavor
out.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the tails that are coming through. And so what we do is we separate those out and we use those. We use the heads for cleaning. We use the tails to redistill and make it into our gin. But the hearts are the only part that goes in the barrel. And so when you have only the most delicious part going into the barrel, you don't need as long to make it delicious.
Interesting.
And
now,
that's opposite of what
did you learn this
from
somebody, or did you figure this out on your
own? It's really, the specific cuts of where we did it were figured out on our own. The general idea of pot still distillation is something you learn. And that's really, you learn organoleptically, which is by smell and taste. You learn how to make those cuts. What are the points that you're looking for?
Mm-hmm.
You can do it by temperature, but it's not quite as good because your nose is way more sensitive than a thermometer.
And then how'd you guys come up with the idea? Like, where did 2 years come from, and what kind of barrels did you decide
and
honestly, to use?
And honestly, the barrel was the biggest barrel that I could move by myself. I was employee number one mm-hmm. and only for a year and a half. So a 30-gallon barrel is the largest barrel that I could
You're
move
like, I can
by
move
myself.
Right. Okay.
Typically, industry barrels are about twice as big, about 59 mm-hmm. gallons. And so
a 400-gallon barrel is something I can get up on a pallet. I can flip it around. I can move it. I can do what I need to do safely. But a 53-gallon barrel is not something I want to deal with by myself with no one to back me up if something were to
totally
go wrong.
Totally with
Can
you.
Can we jump in and just remind everybody, we're talking to Scott and Becky Harris, who are the founders and proprietors of Catoctin Creek Distillery in mm-hmm. Loudoun County, Virginia, the most awarded distillery of the 70 distilleries in Loudoun County.
Yay!
And
they're celebrating their 10-year anniversary.
Yeah, and we met Scott. I mean, man, right when you went into business.
Probably
it must have been 2011, 2010,
yeah, because our show, Foodie and the Beast, is 10 years old.
Okay.
And you guys were definitely on
we were first,
in year one, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the whiskey makeup, or your rye makeup.
Right, and so that's our flagship brand, the Roundstone Rye, which is essentially, we have three different versions of it here today that Scott is getting ready to pour one of the
differences in the versions?
Can't get the bottle
open. So which one are you pouring, dear?
This will be the 92 proof distiller's edition. Why don't you tell
them
about that?
So this one is, we created this version.
Party.
These are all single barrel whiskeys, and what we wanted to do here was...
Okay, and for people who don't know what that means,
that
it means that like you're not doing any blending,
from a
right?
single barrel, exactly. We're not going in... You know, what most of even small batch distilleries do is they'll take, you know, hundreds of barrels, and you can take them of different ages. You can take
create
them of
what
different,
you want.
Yes, thank and you. You create the flavor profile that you want. And it's kind of like the homogenization in that you can create a flavor profile that stays essentially constant over time. Mm-hmm. And what we do is we go ahead and embrace Whoa. That little bit of difference. So the 92 proof, what's fun about this is that Whoa. All of a sudden this one's much more of a spice bomb than the first one.
Without
the first one is just super easy. You don't try very hard. The fruit dominates the kind of flavor profile. In here, you get a lot more spice, but not in the terms of like a dilly spice, because some ryes are very dilly, very heavy.
No, this isn't dilly at all.
It's got more of what I would describe as like
pepper.
A little bit of pepperiness.
Pepper, yeah.
It has some plumminess on the mid palate, maybe some bitter orangey kind of citrus.
A little citrusy. I can see
I
that.
I can kind of get those things going on. And what we wanted to do was create this one especially for people who like more of a scotch style, a little more flavor.
These are your Jack Rose drinkers, right?
Right. And your cocktail mixologists.
Like, order whiskey, order rye, right?
But I will say also,
this
you know, if
delicious.
You're like heading to the Passenger or one of these cool cocktail bars, like this is a fantastic Sazerac too. You know,
it also makes a great pier and a shot, you know, classic industry night kind of drink, right?
Right. So is this something you would just, for? I think there are people who are afraid of brown liquor because they just don't know it. They're uneducated about it. They think they don't like it.
Right.
Would you just serve this on the rocks? How do you feel about it being made into
cocktails?
I like
it on the rocks. I like it in cocktails. I would, when people try neat, I try to start them on our flagship 80 proof version because to me, it's just really accessible. And that's kind of like a gateway drug in some ways that you kind of start to explore flavors of whiskey. Mm-hmm. When I talk to especially a lot of women and women of my age or older who may not have grown up.
Early 20s.
Yeah.
You're very kind.
I love you.
Me too.
Okay, that is not something you were supposed to say.
Well,
that
I
is
mean,
what she's supposed to say.
No, because that meant I married well.
Okay.
And essentially you say, you know, this is the kind of way where it's like, okay, this is really, it's accessible. The 92 proof is where you really start to kind of explore flavor. And I like to tell people that for me, when I started drinking whiskey, because from the beginning of the show when we talked about it, we never really actually, I wasn't much of a whiskey drinker.
Right.
And so for me, it was kind of a, now this is a journey of flavor exploration. And I think that's the kind of thing I like to talk to when I talk to especially women about is saying that just because someone tells you that you're supposed to like it doesn't mean that you're going to like something. And you really, it's incredibly personal. Flavor comes, it's different with everyone's body chemistry. And so you really need to kind of go ahead and just sip on something and explore what do you think about this flavor? What do you taste? And kind of go through that. And so we tend to find that people who taste our products tend to go one way or another. They really tend to like either the 80 proof or the 92 proof plus the cask proof. It's usually
What's
not
the
all
the cask proof is the first one we had.
That's going to be the next one.
The next one, yeah.
The next
the
one.
First
okay.
one you had was the 80, so
yeah,
that's
that was
the softest, 80. The easiest.
It's okay. really soft, really approachable. This one's a little more spicy. Mm-hmm. There are some people who really much prefer that spicier flavor.
I think it's delicious.
And
so
then the third
do you guys
one is
now sit around the house and sip whiskey?
We do.
Yeah, we have drinks probably not every night, but every other night.
All right, let's pour that so we can try that.
And I've been exploring even some of the other profiles. Rye appears to be like my, it's like my wheelhouse. I really love the flavor of rye, and I find it much more likable to my personal chemistry than bourbon. And I've been trying to kind of acclimate myself to bourbon and learning about bourbon. And what do I like in bourbon and what don't I like in bourbon? And I think that's kind of some of the things that I like to talk to people about is that, you know, there are so many different kind of whiskeys in every kind of different flavor category, and that it is something that you can take
this
your time
sweeter.
And get to know.
Okay, so again, so, this is 100% rye
this
again,
one,
right?
These are all 100% rye.
And right. they're all about the same age.
The same age. Thank you. So this is the cask proof I just poured for you. This was actually the first spirit.
What does that mean? What does cask proof
mean? Cask proof
means,
so when these go into the barrel off the still, they go in at 60% alcohol.
Okay.
Okay, and typically then most whiskey, and this is Maker's Mark, this is Jim Beam, this is everybody, you pull it out of the barrel and then add water to dilute it down to 80 proof. So 80 proof is 40%. So you're adding basically for every two parts whiskey, one part water.
Got it.
Right? And so that's one reason it's smoother, because you're adding water to it. Mm-hmm. Well, with cask proof, then we're saying, no, it was in the cask at 60%, and we're going to serve it in the bottle at 60%. So it's a lot more alcohol. And people just think sometimes that it's just more alcohol, but it's not. It's really whiskey concentrate, so it's more, you know, flavor, all the stuff that makes whiskey good, it's right. more of that. And so it's more viscous, it's darker, it's
yes.
richer.
The fatty acids,
the sugars from the wood,
in.
All of that stuff is just richer and more tasty in here. But keeping that still being really smooth is hard. And that's where Becky's really a maestro at this, in that she's able to make a whiskey at 60% alcohol that tastes almost as smooth as what you first
had. Yeah, it's really rounded. Like, it's not...
It's beautiful.
What I like to say
is... It's not sharp.
Yes, that when I've tasted some cask proof whiskeys, that you take a sip and you have to, like, sit there and wait till
the
burn stops.
Yeah.
And you taste something because you're just tasting burn for the first several beats. What ours is the flavor should be really integrated with the alcohol so that the alcohol is burning, but you're tasting something at the same time.
Now, how did you learn this? What was the process for learning?
It was distillation was pretty much, it's distillation is one of the first things you learn chemically, because distillation is separation of any two mixtures by boiling point. So that's not really it. What it is all flavor. And so I was only guided by my, admittedly at the time, inexperienced palate in what I thought tasted good and what Scott thought agreed with me that tasted good. And so we just kind of, led by flavor, really, we
right.
created this whole
the whiskey drinker mm-hmm. initially,
yep.
were there, when you started, were there whiskeys that you were drinking that you were like...
Like, this is a piece that I want to shoot for or something.
This is a flavor profile I'm interested in, or this is what I like, or I don't know. Was there some goal that you had in
yeah,
mind?
Yeah, there wasn't anything that we were doing that was like, I want to make that product, right?
Okay.
We didn't want to do that. But I was drinking a lot of scotch. And so I have a diverse palate. I drink a lot of things.
All know that about you. Don't worry, Scott.
Probably
we got that.
The most things that I was drinking at that time was probably Speyside scotches. So you're talking like your Glenmore, your
sure.
Glenmorangie, and all those. And that sort of fruity roundness that you find in those scotches mm-hmm. was pleasing to me. And so that was something that we were looking for. But we were looking also for something that represented, you know, historical significance in Virginia, because we wanted to be tied to the land and to the history of where we are. And for that, it was rye. So when we first started in our garage, we had done like little 5-gallon batches of a wheat whiskey and a rye whiskey and all these little, you know, test batches. And it was really quickly, we were like, this rye flavor is amazing and we don't see it anywhere else and nobody's doing it. And there's a few, but not much. And so... let's do that. And so it was really about that flavor. And then...
And you buy your product in Virginia?
We do today. At the beginning, we couldn't...
It was really hard because there was really not anybody...
Rye farmers?
Yeah. It was small grains were not a big kind of a Virginia product. So we would keep showing up at the farm events and saying, hey, if anybody wants to grow grains, we'd be happy to build a relationship. We're going to be here. And it took probably 5 to 7 years before we got someone who'd started. And now we have a gentleman down near Rappahannock. He's growing quite a bit, and he keeps asking me, when can I get more? When can I get more? And so we've really grown that. We try to keep it as close to home as we possibly can. We have a little bit of grain from southern Pennsylvania because I don't want to just have a single source. I think
just
every,
in case. I mean, it is farming.
Yeah.
I mean,
that,
anything
absolutely.
Can happen.
Absolutely. We have one farmer who had a really bad year this year, and he
in didn't, Virginia.
Yeah,
I
he
mean,
didn't have anything grow. So we have a couple sources, but I also think that it's important for the diversity of flavor to bring a slightly different flavor profiles from the different
terroir,
grains.
If you
so
will.
We have
right,
four different farmers that we work with, and each one
we
of
call
them
it
is really
dirt.
Soft. Yeah, dirt, terroir.
Yeah.
And all Frenchy though.
Yeah.
And so we bring those in, and that really makes the whiskey more rounded, I think.
Mm-hmm. Right,
yeah,
what'd you pour? Hold on.
So this is
sorry.
The
question.
This
go
is
ahead.
The bomb.
No, that's all right. Go
okay,
ahead.
So I'll tell you. This is the Rabble Rouser. So this is our celebratory release.
Can you give me a little bit of that?
I don't have any more cups.
Oh,
sorry.
Man.
If you go get a cup over here. I don't know where my bag is.
She's drinking from the bottle.
Is that one of those empty?
There, she's got one for you.
Drink it from the bottle.
We so this Rabble Rouser is our special release for our anniversary this year. This is our four-year-old whiskey, so it's twice as old as the other.
It's so good. And it's so good.
It it is what they call bottled in bond. And so there's a cool little bit of history about what bottled in bond means. That's actually a legal determination. It was the first American food safety law ever in the 1800s. So in the 1800s, there were lots of people making whiskey, and there was a lot of fly-by-night operations. So not just blending, but there were people like putting sawdust in whiskey to get it brown real quick, and they were mixing it with unsafe alcohols and all these kinds of things. And so the bottled in bond law basically said, look, this is a whiskey that was made from a single season's grain in this facility, fermented, bottled, distilled, aged, everything in this one facility and under bond. So we have to have a bond, a federal bond for our warehouse. And so that then became a designation for this is the good stuff. This is genuine, and it hasn't been adulterated by anything. And so that is, still exists today, but people had mostly forgotten about it. And now there's a new, you know, sort of resurgence of interest in whiskey. And so this bottled in bond designation is now really popular because it does show that, look, this is a craft distillery, but we don't bottle somebody else's juice. We make our own stuff on site every single time. And so having that designation is really important. And so this then is our release coming out in 2 weeks on February 16th.
Well, in listening to the story, it almost makes it sound like everything, you hit the ball over the fence, but you must have had some epic fails. What? Tell me about those.
The epic fails never end up in the bottle, obviously. So, you know, the biggest fails that we have typically at the distillery are when Becky lets me be in charge of things. So, you know, like dumping the mash from the mash tank into the fermenter, but not forgetting to close the fermenter. So then everything that you dump in there is going onto the floor and you don't see it until it's half empty.
That one's always a good one.
Yeah. That's when you see that happen.
I come in and I just shake my head going, I've told you a thousand times.
That's I meant epic fails in, you know, in distilling. That's just a schmo move.
But schmo moves is what I do best.
Still an epic fail.
Yeah. Actually, when we have flavors now, there is what I would say is one time we were using a certain grain source that we were trying, and it just had a really kind of interesting, it was like almost a dusty flavor
to it.
It
tasted like the bottom of a stable.
It was really weird. And
all right, wait.
So we do 100% of a single grain, so that when we tasted it, we were like, this isn't what we want our whiskey to taste like. And so we had this, and we put it in a barrel, and we aged it. And at the time, then when it seemed like it was getting mature, it was still not better. I didn't like it. And so what we did was we actually took that, because the flavor wasn't what we wanted, and we said, okay, what is a barrel that we could maybe finish this in and see if we can change this flavor into something that's palatable, something that's delicious.
Right. You weren't going to let it go. You're like, no, we're not going to let it go.
No, it doesn't go because it's not right and it's not going to have our name on it. So we took it and we actually had, it took probably two more years it was a beer peach barrel finish. It was a really odd barrel, but it took 2 years before it was like, you know what? This is nice now. I like it. It's really tasty.
So you always figure out something.
Yeah. But
I'm still kind of hung up on how you know what the floor of a stable tastes like.
Well, that's what the whiskey tasting notes come from.
Okay.
And whiskey tasting notes.
You should see some of these tasting notes. Yeah. It's funny because we get reviewed all the time, and we'll have tasting notes that say stuff like, you know, it'll taste like leather and diesel.
Lou Ferrigno.
And then we had one, Lou Ferrigno. Like, I don't
tasted
know what
it like
tastes
Lou
like.
Lou Ferrigno?
Exactly. No, we had
wow.
One. And then we had
which,
one.
Which body part is
I don't know. Armpit?
Not specified.
But then one we had was red shoe polish. And I'm like, as opposed to the black?
Black shoe polish?
Right. Like, I don't know. But
and that's somebody trying to be artistic.
I think they just sort of free associate.
Well, it was funny because when I first started tasting whiskey, Scott, you know, I'd be like, I was very binary with it. Well, I like it or I don't.
Right.
And, you know, there are all these tasting notes and I'm like, I don't know what's right. And Scott's like, the only thing that's right is what you think it tastes like. He's like, you have to kind of embrace your inner bullshit or what you say.
Right.
Kind of when you start talking about things, putting words to it, and listening to other people's words, it kind of reassociates a sort of thing.
Well, I think discussing, just like we did here when we were doing the tasting, you know, tasting a spirit or a wine or a coffee or whatever, discussing its flavor profile, you're like, oh, yeah, I could see citrus. Like, I see how you get that. Or you could say, yeah, no, you're full of shit.
No, that's not mine. Yeah, exactly.
I don't know what you're tasting, but that's not what I'm tasting.
There is a certain amount of full of shitness to that. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Becky does really well is, like, you know, we were having this conversation the other day, especially with, like, female patrons. You know, they will have some sommelier or some guy telling them, like, this is what you should taste, and you should like this because this bottle costs $200 a bottle. And they'd be like, oh, I really just don't like it. It tastes like crap. And you know,
please, don't get me started.
It's super personal. So, it is. Like, you know, I try never, when we're doing a tasting, whether it's professional or with consumers, I let them sip first, and then they have their own experience. Because if I jump right in and say nectarines and plums and cherries, they're like, oh, yeah, nectarines and plums and cherries.
Right. Why? You're like, don't loaded. Force the situation.
Right. You've prejudiced the situation.
Bacon.
Well, right. So when you're drinking scotch, Scotland scotch, mm-hmm. there's this whole sort of procedure that they do with the water drops and the everything. Where are you on that?
There's a little bit of theater to that, certainly.
But proof matters with flavor because different proofs at the same whiskey at different proofs taste different.
Yeah. Of course.
But like a lot of the scotch is at cask proof, so it needs a few drops of water to sort of calm it down and open it up, they say. Mm-hmm. And that's totally appropriate. And it's funny because the first time I did a Scottish distillery tour, they said,
we're going to Scotland, and I'm going to ask you where we should go.
So you should go to Glenmorangie. It's wonderful. but the first thing they say are, do we have any Americans in the audience? And you're like, yeah. And they say, how do you like your whiskey? And we say, we put an ice cube in it. And they all go, you know, like, that's heresy, you know. And, of course, at this point in America, being an American, you know, we have the right to say, you know, screw that. We do what we want. We're
right,
Americans, right? And so, you know.
Is the heresy about ice because it shouldn't be drunk chilled?
Yes, that's more of it, and diluted. And so they do add the water, but with ice you have an uncontrolled dilution, so it continues to get diluted more and more and more and more and more.
But
if you drink it fast.
Also, there's a big difference between ice availability in the States and when ice was available versus when it was available in
Europe.
And,
of course, they don't even drink ice in their Cokes over there.
No,
right.
That's my point.
Well, like, now they've got the Johnny Walker that's the Game of Thrones version that you're supposed to drink chilled.
Yeah, whatever.
So, you know, but you know what I mean? The whole market changes.
Ice is not part of the culture.
No.
Right. Becky's approach to this whole thing from the very beginning was, you know, people would be like, oh, this is too good. I don't want to put it in a cocktail or whatever. And Becky would be like, look, honey, I don't care if you put it in your Dr. Pepper. Like, as long as you're drinking it.
You want a cocktail, just make sure you say Kentucky Cream.
Right, exactly.
All right, we have to wrap this up. Tell everybody, because you have your 10-year anniversary, mm-hmm. what, other than this fabulous bottle that you'll be offering, are there any specialties going on at the distillery where they can find you? Give us everything,
you
please.
You bet. So, along with the Rabble Rouser, which is releasing on February 16th, and that's going to be at noon, and there will be a line, so if you want it, you really should get in line for that.
Get in line.
We will also have our 8-year-old XO brandy. So we have a brandy that was made by Jordan Harris. The wine was made by Jordan. We made the brandy.
From Terrera Winery. From Terrera. He was on our show last week. Yep.
I mean, like, everybody's on this show.
Right. You guys are the tastemakers. It's great.
That's totally true.
So we have those two bottles releasing on the same day at the same time. So if you want those, the 8-year-old XO brandy is the oldest stuff we've ever put out.
Cool.
All year long, we have commemorative 10-year anniversary logoed merchandise like shakers and tins and things like that, which is cool. And then we have in March, we have our 10th anniversary soiree. We're having a Southern soiree with small bites and drinks and a Dixieland jazz band and all this kind of stuff. So we're going to have a great party. It's all on the website, catoctincreek.com. And if you can't spell it, just Google it and they'll get you there.
Right, you'll get close enough. And where is the distillery now?
So you mean physically, geographically?
Yes, physically, geographically.
Yeah, we are located in Purcellville, Virginia, which is about 6 minutes west of Leesburg, about 20 minutes west of Dulles Airport on Route 7.
Excellent. All right. Well, we want to thank you both for joining us today and for what an education.
Thank you guys for having us.
Think say no whiskey, think say no scotch, think say bourbon, whatever it is, the education was given to us today. Next week's show is going to be really fabulous. We have Dr. William Schindler coming in. He is a food archaeologist.
I hope he doesn't bring his list.
I can't help it. That's his name. His name is William Schindler, and he's a doctor.
That ain't my fault.
Okay. I could be your Ed McMahon. That's anytime.
Right.
today Washington, tomorrow Zavarro.
He is a food archaeologist, and we'll be discussing food history with him. We want to thank all of you for joining us today. Do you have anything else that you want to add before I wrap this baby up?
Something that's not stupid? No.
Okay, great. Well, this is David and Nikki Nellis. This is Industry Night at the Line Hotel on Full Service Radio. You can download this show, hear it on iTunes, and of course hear it at fullserviceradio.org. Thanks so much.
Well, that was pretty
have
well
a delicious
done.
Week.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.